means for Wednesday, March 30th, 2005, and open the hearing on SB 5509, the Department of Education Operations and Grants and Aid. The first party up is Ms. Ames.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Ames with Department of Administrative Services. I'm going to be working off of this little document here, which should be on top of your pile for the day.
Which one was that again?
This is in the middle of
it. It's a little packet, like 6 or 7 pages.
Right there.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll be going through a very high-level budget overview just really to help you get some context for this budget. And then the agency will be filling in the next couple of days with the details. I did want to point out before we start that all the numbers in these charts is everything in the Department of Ed budget except the state school fund. Okay. If you go on to page 3, you see the entire education program area, so you get a sense of where this agency fits within all the education dollars. In terms of total funds, the Department of Ed is 12%, and of course a lot of that is federal funding. That's why they're a fairly large chunk there. If you look just at the general fund and lottery, they're 5% of the total funding.
What page are you on?
That was page 3. Just the two pie charts side by side.
Mm-hmm.
The funding. Page 4, just tying this back to the governor's principle process. This budget is entirely within the education principle. Probably not surprising. Page 5. I'm going to give you a series of charts here for the budget that will kind of give you different breakdowns of this budget to give you some sense of proportions. This is their total budget broken down by fund types. So if you look over to the right, federal funds is 3/4 of this budget. Those come from various programs, but if you sort of look at the big chunks, about 1/4 of it's Title I, Children in Poverty, the No Child Left Behind funding, sort of. About 1/4 is IDEA for special education. About 1/4 is nutrition programs, and then about 1/4 is everything else. Then if you go over to the left, general fund in the budget, 17%. Lottery funds at 4%, that is entirely debt service. We're paying debt service on lottery bonds that were issued in the 97-99 and the 99-01 biennia. And then other funds is 4%. If you look down on the left, you'll see where most of those other funds come from. The biggest chunk is really state school fund money that's transferred over to the Youth Corrections Program, and in that process it becomes other funds, and then it's used in that program to educate kids in the corrections system and the juvenile system. Another fairly large proportion is the other state school fund piece that comes over for high-cost special education kids. And that, again, that shows up in these budgets as other funds. Okay. If you go on to page 6, you see the budget broken out by their different program areas. So over on the right, you see the grant and aid programs, 86% of the budget. These are dollars that go directly out to school districts, ESDs, and some other direct service providers. Keep in mind, though, that the administration of these grant programs, the people that run them and monitor them, et cetera, is contained in the agency operations piece. Then, if you go over on the
six. Yes, Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Good morning, Mrs. Ames. The federal funds, are you going to tell us how much of that is passed through and how much remains in the Department of Education?
Yeah, I think. How about when we get to the charts that show the total funding numbers? I'll take a look at that. I think I have all that detail. Okay, then if you go over to the left, you see the Youth Corrections Program is about 2% of the budget at $27 million. Special Schools, that's the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf, is 2% at $21 million. Operations at 6% of the budget, $90 million. And again, remember, this is all funds, including the federal funds. And then the debt service, about 4% in their budget. Then on page 7, the final chart breaks budget up by category, budget category. Down at the bottom, you see 89% of the budget is special payments. That's the grant and aid that goes directly out to districts. There's a little bit of special payments that go out of other parts of the agency. Then debt service, again, 4%. Personal services, that's the salaries and benefits, is 5% of the budget. Services and supplies, that's 6% of the budget. And capital outlay, a small piece, doesn't actually show up as a percentage.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I'm sorry, it's early in the morning, Ms. Sainz. Remind me, where is the debt service? What are we paying for in the debt service?
The debt service is repaying lottery bonds that we issued to give schools money during the 97-99 and the 99-01 biennia.
Operating money.
Yes and no.
Almost. it had some restrictions, but it was very flexible funding, especially the second biennium.
So the state loaned him money.
No.
Borrowed money.
Borrowed. I believe one of them was attributable to technology and.
I believe in each biennium there was a list of different things you could use, including technology and some things that were what you more normally think of as capital. But I believe it included things like textbooks that you normally wouldn't think of as capital.
Yeah. One of the things, Representative Wisnant, that people tend to forget is I know there's a popular wisdom now that the 90s were an area that we were plush in funds. But in 97, the voters also passed Measure 47, and we had to replace it. They passed it in 96. And in 97, we submitted Measure 50 to replace it. That dropped again the amount of property taxes available for the state school fund. So we had a pretty huge chunk to pick up in 99.
So, Mr. Chair, so this is the money that carried over from Measure 5 transitioning, is that what?
No. In terms of the cost to the system?
Yeah.
No. This is actually, Measure 47 further lowered property taxes and actually slowed the growth in property taxes. So you will see a jump in school funding from 97, the 97 biennium to the 99 biennium, but it's largely attributable to that issue is that, obviously growing costs, but the other issue is that as the property taxes did not grow and in some cases went down, it meant we had to backfill with general fund dollars. And the 99 session has been noted as literally the most partisan election, probably, or not most partisan session in that decade, because we fought the entire session over school funding in the House.
Mr. Chair, so
yes.
Is the debt service, are we looking at this $58 million for how many more years?
That's an interesting question, and one of the questions I'd like to have answered. Maybe a quick answer here, but I think it would be beneficial for the committee to see the history of that debt service, when the bonds were issued, whether they've been reissued.
How much they were.
Have we refinanced them?
If we refinance them, and what the, how long in terms of before we pay them off entirely?
Mr. Chair, I do know one answer, and that is we did refinance them this biennium.
Yeah.
And I do know that they continue for a number of years, but I believe they were each 15 years.
That's right, and so I think the total between the two original issuances was $277 million.
Yeah. But I can bring back more of the detail, and we have a whole schedule for the repayment.
But I think it'd be worthwhile for the committee to see that. Where are we at?
Oh, let's go ahead and go to page 8. I have a couple charts in here that are really more for your reference so that you see the numbers. I'm going to point out just a couple of details. General fund, although the overall budget is up almost 14% over 0305, the governor's budget, this is all federal funds. Federal funds are growing very rapidly and have been since 9901. At the same time, that general fund has been reduced in almost 3% since 9901, and corresponding decrease in positions. I was going to look quickly here at the federal funds.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Ms. Ames, do we have, I really like your pie charts. Do we have, you've done the all total funds. Do we have sort of the same breakdown on the general fund and lottery? Well, one of the problems I think the voters have is understanding what happens to their tax dollar. Mm-hmm. When they pay their tax thing, and I have a bill in actually that would put a couple of these pie charts in the Department of Revenue booklet so they see where, you know, how much of my money goes for what and how much comes back to the local areas. And so I would like to see sort of those same pie charts with mm-hmm. the general fund lottery dollars.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's no problem to do. All the numbers are easy. And actually, in my final chart, I do a table that shows just general funds because generally you want a little bit more detail on that piece.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Mr. Question on the positions here in 205, 207 governors, where you have 478. I'm just trying to refresh my memory on the testimony. Was what I'm thinking is like 250 that are actually in the office of the Department of Operations. There's the rest of them are in the School for Blind, School for Deaf. Is that the right breakdown, pretty much, how that goes?
Very close, yes. Okay.
250, and that would be another 220 or something. There's 220.
To address the earlier question on federal funds, let's see if I can actually balance this. We have about a little over $1 billion here in total federal funds, $1.044 billion. About $1 billion is grant and aid that goes directly out to districts.
$1 billion.
$999 million. About $45 billion is in the agency's operation budget.
Representative Jensen has an additional question.
Sorry.
My question is, if we're looking, and I'm on the chart on page 8, 99 through 2005, and we're showing a in general fund a minus 1.9%. If we factor out of this general fund the amount of backfill that we had to do for education, complements of 4750, that is the money we borrowed that we used to backfill for that. What would this look like? Do you have those figures? Can you run the
Mr. Chair, Representative, these numbers don't actually include any of the debt service.
No.
Well, that's specifically
not,
the.
I'm not worried about the debt service.
And they don't include any of that bond receipts that went out to school districts.
Okay.
We incorporated that with the school funding.
So that's minus 1.9. You know, this general fund up here then does not actually reflect the actual amount that went out to schools in 99-01 biennium. There was another, what was it, $250 million?
Representative Jensen, there were, this is actually just the Department of Education. There's, of course, the state school fund, and then in 99 you did have a lottery measure that provided some additional funds, and in 97 you had a lottery measure. But neither one of those actually put money into the Department of Education. They were either included within the state school fund or they were add-ons to the state school fund. I think in at least one case they were, at least in one case, maybe in both, I can't remember, they were done on a per-student basis rather than on an ADMW basis.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, yes. Just another question. You were talking about $45 million federal for operating.
Right. So, Mr. Chair, I was partway through the... Shall I go quickly through the federal numbers?
Maybe you'll answer my question.
Okay, about $1 billion... of the federal funds goes out as grant and aid to school districts and ESDs. $45 million is in operations. $700,000 is in special schools, and about $3 million is in youth corrections.
Committee, when Ms. Ames gets to page 11, she may be able. She may be able to answer a lot of these questions.
Yeah, why don't I go on quickly here? I don't want to take too much time here and let the agency get on into the details. Page 9 and 10 just gives you a really quick look at some issues that you'll probably be looking at in the governor's budget. While education was a high priority for the governor, there are significant reductions in this budget in order to balance. The reductions here that I'm the numbers I'm including are compared to what a current program level would have been in 05-07. So, operations, the governor's budget cuts $2.7 million general fund, including six positions and most of the rest of it in the assessment program. That's about a 7% reduction. The grant and aid programs overall experienced about a 7% reduction compared to current program level. But because we have maintenance of effort requirements in special ed, only a small amount was in those programs. $2 million reduced, which is about a 1% reduction. The rest of the grant and aid money pretty much is coming out of Oregon Pre-K, the $11 million. That's a 20% reduction in that program. And, of course, as you heard yesterday, two of the small grant and aid programs were eliminated in this budget, the Frontier Learning Network and the Student Leadership Center. Then on page 10, there were some investments. The budget does include $4.9 million for caseload growth in the early intervention, early childhood special ed program. It also includes a policy package for $1.8 million for the pre-K-12 integrated data system. That starts the consolidation of K-12 integration of data systems as well as the integration with community colleges and higher ed. And there are similar packages in the budgets for community colleges and higher ed. The governor also included $100,000 for SMART program. Although this is an organization pretty much run with volunteers, they do buy new books for kids as part of that program. In the current biennium, the $100,000 that program had from the state bought about 48,000 books. So they did get a good deal.
Repeat that?
Yes, Representative Wisman.
I missed that statement about this.
In the current biennium, that program also received $100,000 from the state, and they used that funding to buy about 48,000 books. That's part of their program to give new books to kids.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
There was some interest in this as we were talking about it before, and the budget for SMART is roughly $3.9 million.
Statewide?
Statewide.
Yeah.
Which is all from various and sundry other sources, and uh-huh. not anything we're dealing with here today, just informational as you look at SMART.
Thank you.
But, Mr. Chair,
yes.
My understanding, and I appreciate that explanation, my understanding now is that the $100,000 that we saw in the budget was to buy books, and that's what that's for.
Right.
Okay. Just wondering.
But it is only a very small piece of their total
budget. Total budget.
Yeah. Okay. And the current biennium is the first time that the state had made an investment in that program in the L305. Then finally, on page 11 is the reference sheet that you may find useful as we go through looking at more detail of only the general fund budget to get a sense of where some of these programs are in terms of historical funding levels. You can see first I wanted to explain, I did put in the fourth column of numbers that EBL essential budget level. That's our estimate of what it would cost to continue the current program level. It is helpful for me to understand, to give a context for where the program is funded compared to where it would have been if we had just continued it at its current level. You can see operations has had significant reductions in general fund, which we saw earlier in the chart. Special schools did have some cuts during the special sessions in 0103, and then those were carried into 0305. But it hasn't been nearly as significant as other parts of the agency, and the governor's budget did not take any cuts out of the schools. And then I just wanted to point out in the grant and aid, the one program that actually shows increases, early intervention, early childhood special ed, and that is because we have consistently funded the new caseload in that program. And Mr. Chair, I'll finish there, unless there's other questions.
Yes, Representative Gordley.
Thank you. Just going back to the SMART program for a moment, was there consideration on the governor's part to looking for a private partner, the Trailblazers? There's any number of private partners out there who could provide $100,000 to purchase books. Was that consideration given?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't know if there were specific conversations. It's my understanding that significant other portions of that program's budget is funded through private businesses, and that one of the reasons the governor is very supportive of this program is that they try to partner with businesses to find volunteers. But whether or not, but I couldn't answer the question directly if there were specific search for other funding sources.
Okay. I support the program. I certainly support the program, but I also have to believe that there's a $100,000 partner out there in the Oregon community.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Jensen.
I think, as I indicated, the budget is currently $3.9 million.
Yes.
And that's a number of $100,000 contributors. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's all contributed money from one source or another.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some of us, use this as one of the personal charities, if you wish, that we, contribute to. And if you don't, allow me to make a plug for and encourage you to use it as one of the charities you contribute to, because there certainly probably are a lot of other contributors that might contribute to SMART out there. But to the good senator, I think one of the things that that organization does, and one of the needs they have, is in fundraising, And it is, I think, more than the actual value of the $100,000 that the state gives, the image that even the state is willing to make a contribution, small though that is in relationship to the state's budget, but the fact that the state recognizes it in this way, that adds credibility to the program such that they might be able, though, Senator, I would maybe right now hesitate to use the Blazers as a source, for role models for our children.
Not for role models, for $100,000 for books.
As a, but it is the prestige of the state making a contribution that enables them, that helps them be able to raise money in other sources, I believe. And I would certainly support trying to get other people personally as I've done right now, to contribute to the program.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have this question on the operating funds, and I think Representative Wisnett started this out. On this operating funds, on page 6, you have operations funds of about $90 million. And that includes both state and federal funds. And then someplace you made a statement there was $45 million federal funds for operating. And then on page 11, you have $36 million of general funds, and that only adds up to $81 million. So, maybe the good deputy superintendent, we're trying to find this $9 or $10 million. So maybe she's helping me out. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, there's also other funds, and I'd be glad to bring back a list of the various funding sources for operations.
I mean, because I mean, see, the issue that I'm seeing here is that it's $90 million. Okay, that's a non-limited fund. So, see, the issue I'm here that I'm having, all this whole entire budget, if we have to come up with some reductions, I think it's going to be hard for this committee to probably take anything out of money that actually goes out to schools. And the only place that we're going to find any money is in that operating grant, that $36 million plus, now I understand, another $9 million that may be in other non-limited funds. And so, you know, if we have to make that hard decision, from my viewpoint, it's the money that has to go to the schools, the classrooms, rather than to go to the Department of Education. I mean, if we have to make that decision, I mean, hopefully we don't have to. But, so what you're telling me then is, there's $45 million of federal funds. There's about $9 million of non... Is that Sue?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, if you had a chance to look at the LFO analysis, or if you have it with you, it was distributed to you a couple months ago. There's $36 million in general funds, $6.9 million in other funds, $42.4 million in federal funds, and $4.9 million in what we call other funds, non-limited, for a total of $90.3 million.
Okay. That's someplace in all this material.
Probably.
Again, I thank you. That clears up a lot for me. But I mean, you see what our dilemma, or what my dilemma is in this whole thing. You know, I don't want to do this, but if the co-chairs have told us, you know, if we have to make those, if we don't come up to $12.9393 billion, we're going to have to make some cuts. And the only place I've seen to make any cuts is in the Department of Education. So.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Comment from Mrs. Ames and the governor's staff. And for this committee, I know the governor had tough decisions. We're going to have to make tough decisions. But if we're starting on a process that's looking at performance outcomes, the presentations we saw yesterday do not justify a zero budget. That was the student leadership people that we saw yesterday. And I do not understand the governor's action in this, a zero amount for the young people that we had present testimony to us yesterday. That is an outstanding outcome, and that's where we should spend our money.
And you are completed, Ms. Ames, with your presentation.
I have just have one more question.
Senator Nelson?
On page 10,
yeah.
Policy package 102 of $1.8 million for pre-K-12 integrated data systems. And this goes back to my point. I mean, this is for a data system, potentially for accountability, I guess. But it goes back to my general premise is that where is this money best spent? And what is the integrated data system? What does that do exactly?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I'm certain that the agency plans to discuss that in quite a bit more detail.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe better to wait for the official word.
Okay.
The additional question to Senator Nelson's question would be, what would be the impact of the legislature not making that investment? Thank you, Ms. Ames. Ms. Fleming, good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Vicki Fleming, Deputy Superintendent, Oregon Department of Education. We are back again to take another run at having you understand what it is that the Oregon Department of Education does with those FTE that Senator Nelson was referring to. We have a schedule that I believe you have before you. We have 3 days effectively to give you an overview of each of the offices of the Department of Education, and we're starting today with the Superintendent's Office, the State Board of Education, the System Accountability and Policy Development Unit, and hopefully we'll get to the Office of Finance and Administration that's managed by Brett West. I'm going to give you just start with kind of an overview, an environmental scan of where we are. As you know, in our phase one conversations, we were asked to give a high-level overview and talk about the enterprise of education, and we talked in very high-level terms, and according to Senator Devlin, there's still some confusion about what each of the units of the Department of Education do. And so we will attempt to explain that in greater detail, albeit in a very short period of time. I want to start with just some conversation about, let's start with performance measures that Representative Wisnant talked about. We gave
Ms.
you.
Fleming, yes. If I could just interrupt you for a moment. Are you referencing a document now? We have several in front of us.
I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
We have several documents before you, but I'm not going to refer to those right at this particular moment.
Okay.
One of the ways that we had decided this morning and for the next 3 days to present this information to you is through the context of how the Department of Education relates to Oregon school districts. So we've invited several people to be a part of our presentation. This morning we have a superintendent from Hermiston School District, Jerry Wilson, and we've also invited Ken Thrasher, who you know is the former CEO of Fred Meyer and now is his own entrepreneur. So I'm going to start with the environmental scan, then I'm going to refer to the handouts that you have in front of you. There are two packets that you have, one that shows the picture, the colored picture, of how all of the offices of the department relate to Oregon school districts, and that is sort of the organizing principle that we'll use to give you office-by-office presentation. So we're starting this morning with the top circle, the superintendent's office, and we'll describe in detail what the functions and activities are of the people who work in that unit, and then we'll go to the systems accountability unit and the Office of Finance and Administration. Tomorrow you'll hear about Educational Improvement and Innovation Office and the Office of Assessment and Information Services, and then next Tuesday we'll focus on the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships, which is where most of our direct services that we do with around the state reside. Okay? Each legislative session since 1991, with the passage of Oregon's Educational Act, both the Oregon Legislature and the U.S. Congress have passed additional legislation which creates policy and directs the work of the Department of Education. We currently, as you know, have our hands full implementing the No Child Left Behind Act. We're anticipating the reauthorization of two other federal acts, the Individuals for Disabilities Education Act and the Perkins Vocational and Technical Education Act, in addition to continuing to implement Oregon's state mandates. No Child Left Behind, as we mentioned in Phase 1, has really created very high expectations that our schools in Oregon and across the nation are about the success of all students. We talked a little bit about the workload increase that has resulted from the passage of that act. There's a great deal of technical information, data gathering, data analysis that we'll be talking about in detail tomorrow with you, and that's the point at which we'll talk about the integrated data system and why spending money to save money is what we think is a wise decision on your behalf. There are lots of changes under No Child Left Behind that are being considered by Congress. There are discussions at the congressional level about block granting. There's a lot of discussion about the elimination of several of those line item entitlement programs, so we're waiting anxiously to see what the future will look like for that funding stream. With that, No Child Left Behind, the idea of greater accountability has come with the notion of increased flexibility, but the greater accountability is really the job of the Department of Education and the 198 districts that we work with, and the bulk of the increased workload is around how we implement that accountability and that requirement. The requirement for student-level data, as we mentioned before, and we'll get into when we talk about that data system. The P16 policy discussion that you've been hearing about from the governor and from the State Board of Education about how K-12 works with community colleges and universities to improve outcomes for students is another driver for us. We need to be thinking differently about moving students, and Senate Bill 300 that Senator Gordley has sponsored is a vehicle for having that happen. We want better outcomes for young people. We want to remove barriers for their ability to move from high school on to their post-secondary experience. We want to make sure that we're providing a variety of opportunities for students who are not making it in the mainstream of our high schools in particular. So, again, that articulation among systems is a big part of our discussion at the department and requires some very clear thinking and some reaching out across agency and institutional boundaries with the joint boards of education to work on how we craft policy that works better for students. As you know, and you heard some of this yesterday, there is good news in the system that the standards-based system and the system of assessment that we have put in place and the embracing of that policy by teachers and classrooms has resulted in improved student achievement. There are significant innovations that have resulted in new learning environments being created. We have many examples of charter schools that are creating new learning environments for students that are provide a great deal of hope. Acceleration of students on their individual pathways is something that we're seeing. I think we hear about models like the Center for Advanced Learning, where places where students are graduating from high school with either an associate degree or very well far along that continuum. Community and cross-institutional partnerships have been created, as I just mentioned, in the P16 environment. The promise of technology and virtual learning is something that we have to look forward to, and policies around that are an important part of your deliberations. The science of brain research and evidence-based practices about what successful interventions are for various populations of students are an important part of the work that we do at the department. Research and development, if you will. The Superintendent of Public Instruction has created a set of initiatives that are causing new conversations in Oregon. You've heard about some of those, the idea of everybody sponsoring some kind of full-day kindergarten, the importance of early childhood and the connection of the Oregon pre-kindergarten programs to the K-12 environment is a very important part of our discussion. As well as focusing on literacy across the curriculum, we know that we have issues around literacy in our middle and high school environments. And closing the achievement gap, the disparity among Oregon's population of students who are not meeting the standards. So I'll just close and move on by saying that Oregonians and the Oregon education community in general are in the midst of a lot of conversations. We have the Chalkboard Project that's initiated conversations about where we head in Oregon's future. The Oregon Business Council and the Oregon Business Association have very strong opinions about how we ought to move forward. The Quality Education Commission that has been chaired by Ken Thrasher has offered a set of recommendations in addition to how we move forward. We're not all in agreement about the vision for Oregon's future. Our high schools are presenting us with major challenges. Our implementation of the Oregon's Educational Act that changed significantly in 1995 has not been totally systemic. We have pockets of places around the state where there has been full implementation and other places where that has not been the case. We know that Oregon's demographics have changed radically over the last 15 years. The populations represented in Oregon schools represent different sets of needs and issues. And we have a state-funded school system that continues to present us with challenges about what we do and what the nature of involvement of communities and parents will look like. There is lots of rhetoric in this building and around the state about the assessment system, about the value of the SIM and the CAM. What I think was once a grand vision in 1991 has become somewhat less clear, and we look forward to having those conversations in a policy context, but it also has a huge impact on what we do at the department and how we implement it. So I'm going to stop there. We asked Jerry Wilson, Hermiston School District Superintendent, to come. He is the advisor to the State Board of Education, and we ask him here because he's a highly regarded superintendent and is a leader in Oregon's educational workforce, and we also ask him to put a real-world spin on the work and the relationship between the department and the local school district, and not to sugarcoat what it is that we need to continue to do better, because we're very committed to a continuous improvement effort at the department. So I'm going to turn it over to Jerry and thank him for coming this morning all the way from Hermiston.
Superintendent Wilson, welcome. And before you speak, I just want to comment on one thing that Ms. Fleming said. You were talking about SIM and CAM and its place in the scheme of things. And just want to let you know that yesterday we heard, as we were listening to testimony from all those wonderful students representing the leadership programs, various leadership programs, clear examples of students who are engaged in their SIM and CAM work. And if ever there was a doubt about the value of SIM and CAM, those students made it very clear that there is a value. And again, I just want to say that back to you and on the record. And again, welcome, Superintendent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jerry Wilson. I'm the Hermiston School District Superintendent. I have some prepared comments that should be in front of you, and I'm going to speak from those comments and try to follow that narrative. As Vicki mentioned, what I will be doing is framing my comments from the point of view of a school superintendent and how a school superintendent interacts with the Department of Ed. The second portion of my comments will be more from the perspective of the State Board Advisor. When I came to Oregon 5 years ago, my perspective was that the Department of Education had many services to offer school districts. I have seen a steady erosion of support with respect to those services in the last 5 years. Oregon Department of Education faces overwhelming demands to implement accountability systems without a great sense of accomplishment. And what I mean by that is, I think all of education suffers a bit from not a great sense of accomplishment and acknowledgement of the improvements that we're seeing. While gains have been shown in student achievement and other quantifiable measures, increasingly state agencies and districts have been held to tighter degrees of scrutiny with ever-restricted resources. One of the main ways that school districts interact with the department is through the administration of federal programs. The Oregon Department of Education interprets federal program requirements and is perceived as a leader nationally in developing positive educational programs that implement No Child Left Behind. I really want to emphasize the positive nature of that interaction. We see instances across the country where there's a lot of friction in the implementation of No Child Left Behind. But I want to commend the department for its efforts in trying to find solutions and offering fresh alternatives frequently, I think, then, that the U.S. Department of Education has been able to successfully work with nationally. The area that I would most comment then upon would be the highly qualified teacher regulations. I think that's the area where we've really exercised some leadership. I appreciate the proactive support of English language learner proficiency tests and adequate yearly progress, and I think that has benefited Oregon school districts. The downside that I would offer you, and I think this is understandable, but oftentimes I hear my managers talk about the fact that they'll come back with different messages at different meetings because we're in the midst of interpreting these federal regulations. So you may hear that from the field, that there's sometimes confusing messages out there. But when we try to get to the source, frequently what we find is that we're kind of on the cutting edge of trying to make an interpretation. But that would be what I would offer is some of the noise from the field when it comes to federal programs. The second area I wanted to comment upon was the report card as an area where we get that interaction. And here, what we see is that the department is intersecting the state requirements with the federal requirements, and I think that they've done a reasonable job to meet all these guidelines. I think there would be a lot of pressure on the legislature to make changes to the report card in the future. I would encourage you to hold the line to the extent possible, because I believe that we have to have a common system that goes forward over time. And what I perceive in our community, and amongst our teachers particularly, is that there's a growing recognition that the report card and the status within the report card may have some meaning. Because there's a lot of issues when it comes to accountability, when it comes to adequate yearly progress that people don't understand. And I hope that we can maintain what it is that we're doing and not shift it again, because I think then we may lose some of our public.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Dr. Wilson, would you mind if I shared a copy of this testimony with the House Education Policy Committee?
I'd be happy for you to do that, please.
Thank you.
With respect to state policy and regulations, I mentioned that we have a long history of reform in Oregon. We know that our state standards need constant attention. We see that modification taking place. When that modification takes place, we have to adjust our local curriculum, and that will create noise. But I think it's necessary to do that so that we remain current. In other words, what we're doing is we're learning as we implement these standards what changes are necessary to keep our curriculum current. One of the areas that I have some concerns in as we implement textbook adoption is that frequently we're right on top of what the department is doing. In other words, the department may be approving a textbook vendor, and then the districts are turning around and trying to purchase textbooks. It would be helpful if the department could get ahead of the field, and we do have some concerns there. I think, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, from the students' perspective, the current SIM standards are well embedded in our curriculum. And the kinds of public speaking engagement that you may have had yesterday could well be a product of the opportunities that students have in our elementary schools as well as our middle schools and high schools to demonstrate those skills. And I often find if I have the FFA in front of me, they just do an outstanding job. I would remark with respect to the CAM requirements that I believe that they're unequally implemented across the state. And what we see is pockets of excellence where these CAM standards are being able to be implemented, where we have business and community contacts that are sufficient and adequate to support these kind of opportunities for students. And I would suggest that while the department has offered explanations of how model districts have implemented these CAM programs, reduced funding and competing priorities have caused uneven implementation of these important curriculum policies. An area where a school superintendent particularly interacts with the department is with respect to the accreditation or Division 22 standards. And in this regard, what happens is annually a superintendent signs a paper saying that we are in compliance with Division 22 standards. And I believe the department is considering how this system may need to be improved, and I would agree with that. But what I see in general is that the department has done a real good job in melding the federal consolidated grant process and the district improvement model in the work that they're proposing. In doing this, they've reduced the burden to districts in applying and receiving federal dollars. And in the 5 years that I've been a superintendent here, I've really seen some improvement in that respect. I think having experienced other state accreditation systems, more structure tied to a broader set of district improvement criteria will improve our current model. But as a superintendent, I strongly value the flexibility permitted in the current framework. Our district is currently a project site for a high school reform grant, and as such, the school receives technical support as we implement the graduation requirements in CAM. I would suggest, though, the support is modest compared to many grants. We were willing to apply to receive the benefit of this technical assistance, yet I wonder if this is truly the best the state can do to support districts and schools prepared to innovate. With scarce resources, we are diminishing the capacity of the department to support innovation in the field. One of the chief ways that we interact is with respect to the state school fund. And our business managers rely on the department to forecast revenue streams. My comment here is, given the instability in revenues, districts have often had difficulty accurately predicting what its revenue will be. As a growth district, we have been positively surprised by the impact of growth while statewide enrollment declines. And this is an understood variable, but what it has done is created a credibility issue for districts as we announce one figure publicly and then project annual revenues only to find the numbers shift. And when those things happen, you probably hear about that from our constituents. With respect to assessment and reporting, I believe that Oregon State Assessment System has focused schools on instructing students to proficiency in reading and math. Teaching to the test is instructionally sound when the test is an accurate measure of proficiency. And I'm going to use a technical term. This is the characteristic of a criterion reference test. Oftentimes, though, I hear people pushing us to move towards some type of a norm reference test that might be less costly. However, I think that that shift would not meet districts' needs and would cause a huge disruption to the existing balance between curriculum and assessment we have in our state. I believe improvements can be made at the state level to enable districts to obtain better reports given the data the state collects in assessments. And what I see here is that technology is moving so fast, and the kind of reports that we can generate to get to our teachers is often different than what we have given to us. Mm-hmm. And if we can make some improvements there, I think it would really help our schools. An area of commendation I have is for special education and programs for English language learners. We find that the regulations that the department is administering are helping us build strong programs for our students. And the last component I list is often the most important, but I did want to comment about leadership. And here I'm going to speak generally because I believe public education deserves the support of all our public officials. We are tasked with raising the next generation of citizens to be lifelong learners, and we want all our students to graduate post-secondary ready. With accountability, public school officials expect we will be supported in reaching high standards. And I believe all of us need to be unwavering in that support. I appreciated the governor's recent acknowledgement at the state board meeting that he is committed to helping all students go to college. I believe it's a step in the right direction. I want to commend State Superintendent Castile for the Celebrating Diversity Award that's been started. I think that's going to be a great celebration, and I look forward to that. I also want to note that I've seen her in Eastern Oregon several times. And around the state, as she comments on her travels, I think the field very much appreciates that. And I know that at the same time, she's involved nationally in supporting Hispanic education and other initiatives. I believe the state board has established a vision that it is shaping to communicate better with the field. and I think our charge to you is to try to meet the same biennium percentage of resources as much as possible without additional mandates. And here, it's the perception in the field is we're doing more with less. And that's why we look for efficiencies in those mandates if we have to have them. What I'd like to do next is shift to some of the broader state policy roles and shift my perspective in my comments to those as the State Board Administrative Advisor. In this role, in relationship to policy development, I think that what I've observed is that the department has demonstrated a willingness to work with the field in developing policy. However, I find it a great advantage to be able to attend meetings in Salem. My comment is then that I think that the department would be well served to try to bring in some leadership from outside of this area, and they do that to some extent, but I think it's easier to work with those people that are close to you. And I think in this area, policy development is an area that I think that we could get better support. The P16 initiative that the State Board has been working with since I've been on the board, I think aligns well with all the reforms that K-12 has pursued. And it's vital to improving education for all our children. I think, though, one of the challenges will be to blend this with the high expectations we see in No Child Left Behind and getting all our children ready for a post-secondary training opportunity. I think that's going to be a lot of the work in the next 5 years. I did have an error in my written comments. Rather than database initiative, those are intended for the integrated database. And as the effort to align our information systems gets closer to the district level, I expect that greater difficulties and issues will emerge with this system. I believe the concept and intent of state policymakers is right-minded, but there are innumerable proprietary interests and personal quirks that will make this initiative difficult to implement if it is too ambitious. So what I mean by that is, I think we have to be careful when we start trying to dictate what information management systems that individual schools might use. As a school superintendent, I've been through this battle myself, and we find that frequently there are a lot of personal issues that come into play, and it's not to say that it can't be done, but I think we'll have greater cooperation if there are significant resources to support that. So I guess as policymakers, as you look at that initiative, that would be one of my cautionary notes. We see a great opportunity for distance learning in the field, but I believe it's an area that's virtually untapped. And we are looking for leadership at the state level and at the state board level to help forming some of these learning networks. I think multiple issues are beginning to emerge as different districts propose to offer virtual classes. I think the state needs to certify the quality of programs and help districts sort through some of the issues that will emerge, such as those with teacher licensure, funding, and accrediting sources. My last comment is going back to school accreditation, because I believe that that's an area that the State Board is going to be looking at with the department here in the near future. The present direction of the department, I think, strikes a balance between state and local control. I am somewhat cautious, though, of any district accountability to ESDs in school accreditation. Instead, I believe that the model should remain a strict line of accountability between the local education authority and the state education authority. And in this respect, I think the role of the ESD in school improvement should be for technical assistance that is available statewide as well as regionally. I hope these comments are helpful to the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Superintendent Wilson, not only are the comments helpful, your presentation is excellent. Thank you so much for your thoughtful comments. picking up on your earlier statements around SIM and CAM opportunities for students, what you're telling us is that there is currently inequality of opportunity for all students to fully participate in activities that would support gaining a certificate of advanced mastery in particular. And as you make that known to us, are you describing the current situation in your community as it relates to these opportunities?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, I am. I believe we are working to address those issues, but as I have the opportunity to travel in the state and see some of the model programs that we have, there are some tremendous learning opportunities for children in the Portland area, whereas we struggle to have similar partnerships in rural Oregon. And I think that it's not that our business partners aren't willing. Sometimes the opportunity for the dynamic partnerships that I see existing with technology, for instance, simply aren't in our area. We can find ways, and I think we will find ways as we go forward, to model some of those opportunities. But my comments are directed towards encouraging us to continue in this area, but realizing where we have division, and we have a lot of work to do.
If I may ask one additional question, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Senator.
Thank you. Superintendent, this goes to your comments around distance learning. Are you currently engaged with the department in its efforts to look at how we might grow, if you will, distance learning opportunities for students around the state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordon, yes, I have been working with the department mostly as a policy advisor in that respect, as I've had some experience when I was a superintendent in Wyoming in helping grow those networks. And what I have found is that we haven't really tapped that resource to the extent that I'd like to see it tapped. So some of the work that I'm doing in our district will be towards putting together policy around that so that we can move that forward, and wanting to offer high school students especially some distance learning opportunities. But presently I see some barriers that it would be useful if the state, through the department or the state board, would address. And in working with the department, we've been doing that more so though as a policy advisor to the state or to the Oregon Department of Education rather than in our district.
Mm-hmm. And if I may ask a follow-up.
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Are you familiar with the Frontier Learning Network?
Somewhat, I am.
Are you familiar enough to comment on where and how that approach would fit into how we might grow distance learning opportunities for all students?
I can't comment on that.
Okay.
I would suggest that what I see is needed in our school district is that we have a transparent model whereby parents and students would be able to speak to the school about what their interests are, and that some way we configure that within their curriculum. And I see most of those opportunities presently as extensions either to Eastern Oregon, Blue Mountain Community College, Chemetica, whatever the provider might be, so that we can extend their learning and enrich that learning opportunity.
Thank you for your leadership.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson. Just for the committee's information, Jerry's going to leave us. He's going to go to Colorado. He has a better job offer with the largest school district, a career advancement, going to a largest school district with the university. I think it's Fort Collins, is that?
That's correct.
That's where he's going. So he's moving on. But you can see why I have some good superintendents out there in my part of the country that do some good things. I do have some questions, I guess. So one is, you know, I know your experience. You came from Wyoming. You've been around. One, I'd like to know, how do you think Oregon compares its education system? I mean, how are we doing, basically? We always beat up on ourselves. What's your response to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, as I've shared with you, I have the highest respect for Oregon's education system. And my reason for choosing to leave Oregon is only because I couldn't find as good a job in Oregon as what I was able to find in Colorado. I'll be moving to Fort Collins, which is a school district with 24,000 students and, as you mentioned, a university. So that's a unique professional development opportunity for this point in my career, and I have no sour grapes towards Oregon whatsoever. What I have experienced in Oregon is that, much like I had studied before coming to the state, that the state was highly successful in implementing the standards and developing assessments. I've been particularly pleased with the level of performance assessments that the state uses, in other words, the writing and the problem solving, and the fact that we're doing that as part of the curriculum at the elementary level, the middle school, and then as our kids graduate. I have two children that have become Oregon high school graduates, and I expect they'll be in Oregon university system. So, you know, we have the highest respect for the system itself. I think, though, in relationship to what I see going on nationally, some of my comments with respect to setting higher expectations is an area that I think that Oregon has to carefully consider. And I know that's being done at the state board level and at the department, conversations I've had with some of our department officials. In other words, some of the internal conversations there have to do about whether the SIM is appropriately placed at the 10th grade level. Should it be placed a little later in the student's career? What is the effect of having it at the 10th grade level rather than a little later in the student's career? And I think one of the other things that I feel is right-minded is the PASS system, but it really hasn't taken hold. And we need something to really set a high mark in our schools. And I believe, and we're working very diligently towards putting advanced placement classes into Hermiston High School. And we are adopting a curriculum, I believe, here in the next few months to align our sixth grade classes, beginning in the sixth grade, to those higher standards. And I believe right now that's going to be an important consideration as Oregon moves forward and wants all students to be ready for post-secondary opportunities, that we have that kind of dialogue around that. You see that taking place in other states. That's not why I'm moving to Colorado. It's taking place in other states like Florida, for instance, where they have an expectations that all students will have at least one AP class before they graduate, so that they have a sense that they can tackle that tougher curriculum.
Follow-up? Yes, Senator Nelson.
You talked about some of the things about the leadership and, you know, getting the public involved. One of the issues that I'm seeing or hearing about is the conflict that we're developing between the No Child Left Behind and the Oregon Report Card, where the school passes on one and fails on another. To me, that sends a very confusing message to the public. What's your sense of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I agree. I think right now, what I see is a greater reliance upon the Oregon system of accountability than the federal system of accountability. I think it's fairly well established. We know what it means to be average or adequate in the state system and strong and exemplary. And we're starting to aim at those internally. We are very much closely following how we can have our schools reach those higher benchmarks. But in the federal system, it's one of either you make adequate yearly progress across a broad number of sectors, and in our high schools, it's a huge number of different areas that you have to show that you have met. Otherwise, you are low performing. And I think that divide is in our estimation, it's a punitive system rather than a system that gives recognition for various levels of achievement, which is where I think the Oregon report card does a better job. But our requirement is that we put them both together. So, frankly, I see more people paying attention to the Oregon rating system than the federal system because it's so cumbersome and it's hard to follow. Now, if you want to beat up schools, it's easy to do with the federal system.
How do we solve that? I mean, you've got the federal funds that are tied to No Child Left Behind. And, I mean, how do we resolve that dilemma? Is there any resolution? We're just going to have to muddle through? Is that...
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I think there's a real role for our state legislators in this respect, because I think you can have the year of our congressmen maybe in a different way than what we can. So much of our state resource now is for education you have authority for. And I think the more dialogue that you have with our federal legislators with respect to these conflicting systems and leaving control for these where the real resources reside. Only 8 to 9% of the resources that we receive at the district level are federal resources. Yet we have quite a bit of direction coming from the federal level, and I think the conversations you might have with our congressional leadership might help us.
We've done, Senator Nelson.
Go ahead, if you're going to follow up on that question.
Who's on first?
Yeah, you're on first.
Superintendent, I'm struck by some of your comments around No Child Left Behind. And granted, there is the conflict in the reporting. But understanding that, where would we be without No Child Left Behind?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, your point's well taken. No Child Left Behind has put an important focus where it needs to be. I would say, though, that the problem is in the details. And we are having a focus on all children that we may not have had and likely did not have before we started breaking information into these different areas and then showing what these differences are. And it has pointed us in directions we needed to go. I think the difficulty comes, though, in what I suggested with respect to the idea that a school is identified as low performing when a subgroup may not have had not had as many students tested, and we look at the margin of differences as very small. As an example, there are many technical reasons, or seemingly technical reasons when it gets right down to it, that districts or schools fall into difficulty. The other aspect of this, and I'll be frank with you and candid, we talk about, or within this legislation, there's reference to best practices. We have a lot of work to do to build systems that educate all children. I think that we have to be understanding that the direction and the focus of No Child Left Behind is where we need to be. But I don't know that I believe that as we continue to ratchet up those numbers, that we have built systems in the past or can look to systems that have been successful to the extent that these expectations are going to lead us. And so as we go forward and we continue to measure and we continue to build improvements, the idea that if we miss it by a small margin, but we're seeing increasing growth, we have to find a way to reward growth and recognize growth. And that's where, when I talk about the celebrating diversity achievement, when we have a school that has made some of those improvements, that's what we've done. We have grown in those areas.
Just a follow-up. Superintendent, in your work, do you draw on the resources of the Education Trust?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley. I do professionally and share that information with my administrative team. And
in terms of best practices.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes, one follow-up. I mean, the difficulty we're having here is if we're going to get down to a choice potentially here. I mean, as a superintendent, this, if you had to choose between textbooks and the state having an integrated data system, I mean, what do you choose? And that's kind of what we're at. I understand from your testimony that you're very supportive of the Department of Education. I think we all are. But we may come down with a co-chair and say, you've got to take $5 or $10 or $15 million out of the education budget, and I'm not willing to take it out of grant and aid programs. I mean, I'm going to have to look to the Department of Education in order to do that. So, I mean, that's probably not a fair question, but.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, you've asked me this question before, and in all fairness, I have attempted to have a response where I tend to see there's the possibilities for some kind of efficiencies. Frankly, I don't know the department that well that I would make that recommendation or could make that recommendation to you. I do believe that when you say, if it came down to textbooks and the integrated data system, I think that in the short term, we just may not get there as quickly because students need textbooks on a daily basis. The integrated data system is a long-term vision for the state, but it's extremely important because ultimately what we're going to do is know more about our system itself and how we can make some improvements that are going to benefit all kids. But the choice you posed me is a difficult one.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Senator Whitson, good morning.
Good morning. Superintendent, this is a question that I've asked of a number of superintendents in our district. It appears to me that our increase in the rate of employee compensation is not sustainable. And if we graph the projected increase of revenue stream in Oregon for the next few biennia and the increase in just the current number of K-12 employees, they cross at about 2014. As a businessman, that would give me cold chills. In order to maintain that rate of growth, we would have to virtually double our revenue stream into the general fund, lottery fund aspect. We don't see that happening. So how would you address that as a superintendent? I mean, can you help us understand how we can address that reality?
Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, I think that you've asked an extremely important question with respect to how can we be sustainable in public education and meet the demands that we're trying to meet with educating all children. And I agree that the business model doesn't look very promising with respect to benefits. It's an area that we struggle with. I think in terms of sustainability and benefits themselves, what we are talking about are the trends relative to individual components of the benefit package. So if we break it down and we speak about health insurance benefits particularly, what we would be talking about is the trend towards seeing if we can get more of our employees to take on a greater burden of the health insurance cost, and thereby understand that that's one of the means that our providers are telling us that business is also using so that we can better control the costs. As employees, if they only have it as a benefit, then they aren't as wise of a consumer. So I think that by 2014, if we can be moving in that direction, we're going to make some improvements and possibly stem some of these rising costs that we're seeing in the short term. With respect to retirement systems, this is an area of deep concern, and the legislature has addressed that issue, and some portion of it's still before the courts in terms of overall settlements. But I think that the direction that the state has taken has been wise, and we need that relief at the district level as we go forward, because that part of the curve also troubles me a great deal. I'm not a person that spends a great deal of time looking at retirement systems, so I don't feel adequate to comment other than a very general way, but I do believe that it's an area that's going to require consistent attention at this level, at the legislative level, and we need that support at the district level, because we are simply a consumer of the system itself. As a district superintendent, we pay whatever the rate is, and that's a burden that we're going to be facing. Those are the two areas that I see as the most prominent issues. I hope that helps.
And if I follow just a moment, it's not just a problem with K-12 education. It is a problem in the whole system, as you pointed out. And I think that's, but I mean, it's, to me, again, it's something that we all have to look at and address, and we've got to stop ignoring it, because 2014 is coming.
I agree.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Well, even though I have not been here for all of your testimony, I've been here for part of it, and clearly enough to see that Oregon's loss is Colorado's gain. So,
my pleasure.
Ms. Fleming, who is next?
Senator Devlin, I'm going to fast forward through much of what we planned this morning. You indicated over the last couple of weeks that the committee is still unclear about what the department does, so I just want to frame the next part of our presentation.
I want to make it clear to the committee that was my perception.
All right. Thank you. I just would tell you a little story, and that was that 2 years ago at this time, when we started working with the then chair of the education subcommittee, Representative Susan Morgan, we went to visit her, and she had our organizational chart laid out on her floor with butcher paper and post-it notes, trying to figure out the same thing. What is it that we would do, that we do at the department? And as we began to work with her, we began to focus on the idea that what we need to understand is what are the functions, core functions and activities of the agency, rather than focusing on the FTE and the people in the offices. So what we've prepared over the next 3 days is a look at both ways of viewing the department's work. So to Senator Gordley's question, I want to tell you what you have in your handouts. We're not going to have time to go into these in detail, but for your reference, the packet that looks like this, that says testimony on the front, includes our overall agency organizational chart in the new Oregon Department of Education, what the offices look like. There's a page that describes the core functions and strategies that we are undertaking at the department and the superintendent's priorities. The next page is something that you've seen before, which is a timeline and an overview front and back page of our, looks like this, this project timeline, where we are with our performance measures, that we know that we're going to come back to you with a set of approved performance measures. There's an article in here that refers to what Jerry Wilson was talking about, which is the general national trend about state education agencies and their lack of capacity and infrastructure to support school improvement activities, and I would appreciate it very much if you have time to read that. And then the last document in that packet is an overview of a corrective action plan that was our first internal audit on the youth corrections education system, so you can see a little bit about what the internal audit function looks like at the department. The other packet that's covered, where the front page is the colored sheet, is the thing that will guide our conversations with you over the full 3 days. So we've given you a picture of the agency's work as it relates to school districts. The second and third pages are trend line projections of where we've been in terms of our positions and our budget in the agency, so you can see what that looks like over time historically. The third document that is titled Superintendent's Priorities and Initiatives is the description that you asked for in the line items in our budget that talk about accountability, leadership, school improvement, and the superintendent's priorities. What is it that actually happens as a result of those line items? And the third is the office-by-office breakout, which our assistant superintendents will be using to inform their individual office presentations. So you'll see on the first page, where I start with Office of the Superintendent and the State Board of Education, the functions and activities that we do. These are all correlated to the slides that you have. There's so many ways to look at this. I hope we're not confusing you even further, but our attempt was to clarify and to be specific about what are the activities that we do on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. The last handout in that packet is references Senator Whitsitt's question about federal fund breakout. What do we mean when we talk about supplement, supplant? What is it that guides us in how we use federal money at the State Department versus how it goes out the door and is distributed to school districts? So we'd be happy to answer any questions about that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Is there, in the materials I'm still looking through, related to the organization overview and the organization chart, is there a description of the chief of staff communications component?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't have a specific page that describes the activities of the chief of staff, but in my remarks when we get to that section of the presentation, I do have a brief overview of each of the positions that are on the Office of the Superintendent.
Okay.
I'd be happy.
One of the things I'm wanting to better understand, and I do appreciate that the superintendent has been in communication with my office with a letter describing the function of the chief of staff. I'm still unclear on whether the chief of staff is chief of all of the staff on the organization chart, this whole chart, or if that's just a title and a function solely related to the communications function. And then the other part of my question, which makes people gulp, is if there were no investment in that part of the organization, what would that mean for the organization?
Senator Devlin, Senator Gordley, would you like me to answer that now or as we move through the presentation?
Yes, wherever it is appropriate. The question is on the table.
Thank you.
Kevin Thrasher wants to testify. He's come a long ways.
Oh, that's right.
Senator Devlin, may I proceed?
Yes.
I think we're getting to exactly what Senator Nelson is asking for. When we went through our reorganization 2 years ago, we convened a group of people from the business community representing a variety of perspectives to inform how we should be doing our business in the future. Out of the $6.4 billion investment that you have before you in the budget that Ms. Ames went over, approximately 1.4% of that is for the cost of the overhead and the administration of that that $6.4 billion public investment. We've asked Ken Thrasher to come and give you a little bit of a perspective from the private sector about that issue of how much should we be spending and what are you buying to oversee that investment in Oregon's public education system. So I would stop and invite Ken to come up and give his remarks.
Mr. Thrasher, please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ken Thrasher. I'm the CEO of Complete, chair of the Quality Ed Commission, and the retired CEO of Fred Meyer. So, thank you. I wanted to come and address you this morning about the issue that I know is in front of you, because I think the real topic you're dealing with is centralization versus decentralization. And I think it's being based on a little bit of the economic environment that we are in the state, but also I think there are some very significant long-term implications of the decision process that you're going through that are probably weighing on all of your minds. And as I come here today, I want to come here from three points of view. I want to talk about the references to the Quality Ed Commission report, because I think in that report, which you have, most of you have probably already seen or read, there are a number of references about how this centralization process probably should be strengthened, not not eliminated in many, many cases. The second is from a business point of view, as the CEO of Fred Meyer, why centralization and dealing with some of these issues centrally is really important. And the third point of view is I was had the opportunity to go to the National Governors Summit on High Schools, and there was a lot of discussion there that I think is relevant to the topic that we're discussing here today on where the trends are nationally relative to these kind of issues. From the point of view of the Quality Ed Commission, I think there really are four topics. There are the issue of governance, accountability, efficiency, and federal No Child Left Behind legislation. In the area of governance, I really do believe, if you read our report and see the connections we make, that the standards that are administered at the state level, the integration of the silos, the decision-making, and the intervention activities that go on around student, teachers, accounting, data, and other outcomes have to be managed centrally. And the reason it is I don't know of any system that runs well when you let 198 separate organizations run that system themselves. And so the more we decentralize that process, I think the risk is, both an efficiency risk and a governance risk, that we kind of end up with the potential of losing some of that control of the accountabilities, which is the second point. And accountability today is a different model because what we've done with state funding, the majority of state funding is state-driven. And so as legislators, it would be my guess that you would understand that those monies are being well spent. And so from an accountability standpoint, more so than ever, centralization versus decentralization is an important element. And you're at a 1% to 2% cost. That is actually not a bad percentage relative to what we would see in the corporate side of America. An efficiency standpoint, and this is something that in the National Governors meeting there was discussion about what's going on with technology, Internet 2, computers in schools, buying for textbooks, etc., how that efficiency around the acquisition of services, buying leverage, integration of systems, networks, and technology can be leveraged significantly when done centralized. And then federal No Child Left Behind, there has to be a coordinated approach. We have to have one set of reports and standards that we can compare districts on an equal basis and make sure that whatever we're doing is addressing the issues of rigor, some standards around what we expect out of each school, those integration of those silos so that we move more kids through the system faster and start to deal with early childhood and the connection with our college system in a much more efficient manner. From the perspective of corporation, you know, I was at Fred Meyer. We had 135 stores, so there's a lot of similarities between the school system here and our store systems. And, you know, each one of our stores, on average, was a $40 million business. So it was a big business. And the CEOs in those stores were the store managers. They had a lot of discretion, but at the same time, the standards which we made for operations were done centrally at the corporate level. The systems buying, the processes around administration were done centrally. And the reason that that was important is because then we could compare stores on a fair basis. And we could buy technology and be much more efficient in the delivery of that. And you know what? We didn't give people the choice of whether they adopted the standard or not. They had the standard. And when something happened from a governance standpoint and a store didn't perform, we took our best managers and put in those stores that had the worst performance, which is very similar, I think, what the process is has been prescribed in what we've talked about with education. We had those common data systems because we could leverage the network and the buying of systems and saved a lot of money, which I think in Oregon there's a tremendous opportunity. We talk about saving $20 million here in this potential, but if we looked at how we integrated systems statewide, there's a much bigger number there. Now, while there's a capital cost, there's also an efficiency cost down the road that is much greater than the value it is, and it will deliver outcomes to students in closing that achievement gap and connecting kids with the college system much more effectively than the approach we're using today in a decentralized environment. We bought our supplies. Our health costs were negotiated centrally. Things like, Senator Whitsitt, your comment about the PERS system, absolutely, it needs to be relooked at. There are three elements to that. We would look at that at a Fred Meyer as we had a ruling. We had Judge Lipscomb's decision to look at. We would go back and reassess what that strategy is going to look like, what those costs are going to be going forward, and understand the impacts, look at the alternatives, and try to pick something that could actually mitigate that exposure. Same thing on health costs. But that's how we would look at those from a corporate perspective. And the state owns that. You all, as you know, own that process. Our training, employee standards, performance around best practices, in this case teachers' practices, would be done centrally. They'd be established on employment practices and approaches, performance evaluations, so that we had a commonality amongst our how we treated our employees. So there wasn't a variable there where one employee could raise the issue about how they're being treated relative to others. So there was a standard. You could see. Can you imagine each Fred Meyer store negotiating everything for themselves? Would it be more efficient? Absolutely not. The last point I want to make is at the National Governors Association Summit on High Schools, while it was focused on high schools, there was a lot of discussion amongst the governors that talked about their states adopting more rigorous standards and deploying them from the state level. So there was a commonality across the system, having oversight and governance and accountability and interventions built in under the auspices of the governor and the Department of Education that would really focus on really two things: closing the achievement gap and connecting kids through dual credits and AP and other programs to get them through the system faster. The last thing that was also talked about significantly is reconnecting through those silos into an integrated approach, is to get early childhood brought forward as a strategy, along with bringing the business community, social service providers to the table, so that your data system can connect to each of those populations where they're needed to be connected. That's the value of having an integrated system. It isn't just educational outcomes, it's human outcomes we're talking about. And that's why I believe the more we can centralize and connect those through what the department does, the more efficient the system can be in delivering the outcomes that we're asking. If we take the dollars out centrally and move it out and the activity out, you have to also measure activity. You can't just measure the dollars. You have to say, what am I moving? What's the impact it's going to have on each school district? If 198 school districts add one person, that's a $10 million cost. So immediately you have to ask the second question is, if I take it out here, what does it do there? That's the strategy I think we all have to deploy in analyzing whether or not the decision, number one, is first the good decision is the work necessary, and the second decision is what's the financial impact that we'll have in making the system more efficient. But I think our goal, and what we're looking at with some of the consolidations on the infrastructure in our report, the ESD consolidation, the data system consolidation, all of those are ways to actually create long-term value for the system. And my guess is, I'm going to throw a number. I know there's over $100 million there if we look at how we integrate these more effectively. Now, the department with Doug Costi and some others have started that process. And you talked a little bit about the funding of that, whether we should do it or not. I think the challenge I have to ask you is, if you don't do it, what are we going to do 2 years from now and 4 years from now? We're going to have the same discussion, but we're not going to improve the system. So we have to, at some point, put the stake in the ground and say, is the process of centralizing some of these activities to be more efficient the right thing to do? And I think it is. And my business background tells me, based on 20 years in the retail business with a large corporation, that that makes a lot of sense for us to do that. So I think our goal here should be to try to actually strengthen what we do at the department around these standards, and have the 198 districts be enabled by what the department does, and centralize more and not less. Thank you for listening to my comments. Any questions?
I'm sure we will have a few questions. Where should I start? Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your volunteering on this committee, and thank you for your leadership. Congratulations on the success with Fred Meyer. I think one difference is, would you tell me how many store managers you replace in a year? And I don't think we have that same ability and do that in our school superintendents. I think your other comments are very good, and I want to listen to them again on the tape. But I think replacing management is more difficult in our system than it is in your system.
Chair Devlin, represented, wasn't it? I think the key is having a process to manage that. That's a workforce management issue you're talking about. And that means you have to be able in the system to also identify who your up-and-comers are based on performance evaluation and process. That should be something that's done, I think, also can be viewed statewide. You know, to see a superintendent like Superintendent Wilson leaving our state, I hate to see that. But a system should be able to identify statewide where there are people that are ready to make the next step and make sure that we offer them that opportunity when their performance underneath them, based on the evaluations we've done in the systems, will provide that data. So I think it is an employee retention issue, and it's an employee hiring issue that you have to have a strong database to support that. Now, can the districts do that individually? Some can, probably, the larger districts. I think it's tough for small districts to do that. But if you had a statewide database of performance and other things, you could be able to probably manage some of those things very effectively. That's what we did at FedMire. We knew which managers were what part of their career development, where their training requirements were needed, where they had gaps, so that we could fill those in and move them through. We also knew where we had performance issues, so we could deal with them. So I think that the model works the same.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. But again, how about the people that don't measure up and they need to be put aside or lowered down, or they've reached the ultimate of their management level, or we need to replace them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, that is a progressive discipline process, and it has to be something that you are willing to do on a regular basis and deploy, and that is a performance evaluation system. And it isn't once a year. It's what you do day in, day out, looking at how the performance of your students are doing within the system. That is the key performance measurement that we should be looking at in every school.
One last follow-up.
Yes. Thank you.
My experience is in the U.S. military, and we have wing commanders that are, you know, on the way to be generals, and if their wing doesn't meet the IG inspection, they're replaced. Their career is over. We don't have that opportunity to do it in our education system.
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, I think that is a policy issue that the state should look at.
Okay. I think one response to that, too, is that you would admit that part of not having to replace managers or not replace that many is making wise choices in the beginning of who you selected as managers. So.
Chair Devlin, that's correct.
Senator Nelson.
You know, this performance measuring for managers, I mean, you'd have to even go one step higher, and I think you'd do this. You'd look at the central agency and say, for instance, this agency has 250 employees. Perhaps you could do the same amount of work with 200 employees. I mean, you would look at something like that in a business model, wouldn't you?
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, the thing is, you have to understand what activity you're trying to manage.
Yeah.
And then you have to understand what it takes to do that. And that's the process. But I think the concern I have is if you just make a random cut and you reduce capacity without understanding what you're reducing the capacity to do, and you move activities out without understanding the impact, the ripple effect may be as you add more cost back.
And
you may have a long-term impact that's very damaging to the system.
I mean, to me, a corporation would look at it and say, okay, we can do the same job with 200 employees rather than 250.
Right.
Do it just as well, maybe even better, and rearrange things. I mean, I know that the department is reorganized, but is that the D model that we have to accept? I mean, you know, it's not that I want to change it or anything like that, but I mean, if we get down to where we have to make these decisions, we want to be more efficient. I would like somebody with your skill and ability, somebody to just analyze it on an independent basis and say, okay, perhaps this could be reorganized a little bit different at the central level, and with the idea that we want to centralize all these things. I mean, that's just a thought in my mind. Another question is, would you advocate for statewide salary negotiations in this thing? Is that part of the centralization?
Chair Devlin and Senator Nelson, that's a real tough question because you have existing contracts out there. How would you? Now, Fred Meyer had contracts. We had contracts in Seattle. We had contracts in Portland. But there was an oversight at the Portland office of all those contracts. They were centrally negotiated. So the model can work.
Yes, Senator, Representative Jensen and Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Chair, for but I'm hesitant to get into any of the Fred Meyer analysis, certainly. Partially because in their wisdom at central office, they never chose to come to my part of the state. And as a consequence, I have developed no personal empathy, I guess, for... However, I have had, limited though it may be, some background dealing with major corporations. And some of whom are competitors. Fred Meyer. And I'm not always finding, as I, in my limited experience, the degree of efficiency that might be there. For my distinguished colleague from the military, I had some background with that organization too. And I would observe that I didn't always find the high degree of efficiency that might have been there. But all of those things beside, and without getting into them, we have a structurally and emotionally, value-wise, a very different culture that we're dealing with in relationship to perhaps education than we may be the other organizations that we might be talking about. For one thing, in terms of this centralization, we've got a local option, local control issue, which may be, even as it is now, overstated, but tends to be a very fairly high value as far as the citizens of the state. And I don't want to say that any large corporation is not involved in politics, because I know that's not true, that there's a certain amount of politics that goes into any of these things. But that's a, if we were to, you know, tempt some of the things, I think we'd run into, you know, some real major political problems and issues. And I would be interested in how we're going to, how are we going to tell all these local school boards that you no longer exist, or that you're only here as a showpiece for the idea of local control, which they complain too much about already. I think the superintendent can verify that they get very concerned about, you know, all you want us for is a rubber stamp, or, you know, and sometimes they rebel against this, and sometimes the communities rebel against it. But we are talking about two basically different phenomena, types of organizations here. And while I appreciate the analogies, somehow it seems to me these analogies always break down somewhere along the line. And I'd be interested in how we overcome those points where they break down.
Chair Devlin and Representative Jensen, I appreciate your comments, and I'm sorry we never came to your area with a Fred Meyer store.
It's your loss.
There are no perfect organizations, and I think I did not say that I felt we should eliminate school boards. I think school boards, like us, there are similarities. In the store, we had store managers that ran the store and store department manager. They had a lot of autonomy to sell in that store, as I think school boards have today. But ultimately, if a school board and a school district are making a decision not to offer Algebra 2 to students, ultimately you're affecting their ability to move to the next level. So those are the kind of decisions, is the level
of rigor in that classroom, the accountability to that rigor, the school boards should really be held accountable for to make sure that those things get done. And we have, it's all over the ballpark still in our state. And that's where I think having a reasonable standard and explaining it and explaining the impact it has, not just to the student, but to the economics of the state long term, the impact it's going to have, is an important element. It's a communication process that I think the department working with school boards should be involved with.
Senator Whitsitt, and then there'll be one. Well, Senator Whitsitt, and then I'll take one more question from someone else.
Mr. Tasher.
Oh, you were in line. I'm sorry. Senator Whitsitt, I apologize. I already had mentioned Senator Gordley was already in line.
I'll defer to my colleague.
Okay. Please proceed.
With the, I'm trying to regain my thought here. With respect to the school boards, they're elected. And so what form of sanction would you envision in order to enforce your centralized rule?
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsitt, I think the sanction is something that legislature, the department, agree to. It's whatever we believe is a reasonable process to go through from a, whether it's in a business, a progressive discipline process, or whether it's in a school district dealing with the failure to achieve outcomes and to have a curriculum that's rigorous and meaningful. Those, I think, are going to be controlled by whatever standards and rules you set up. And then you're going to deliver a series of steps that are going to occur, whether it's an improvement plan to start with and a period of time to deal with that, and then whether it's you have some form of intervention, and, you know, you end up with the school closure or an alternative, a competition, which is a charter school. That's what happens. And whatever we agree, it should be a standard that's fairly and equally applied based on outcomes.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Thrasher, for your leadership and for being with us today. As you are well aware, we are functioning in the state of Oregon with a tax structure framed in the 20th century. And we are trying to meet the needs of the 21st century with a revenue gathering system that is inadequate. What are you and the Quality Education Commission willing to do that would help move Oregon toward as we look at reform, the need for reform of the tax structure? What are you willing to do to move us toward not just the discussion about a sales tax dedicated to funding education, pre-K through higher education, but to actually moving to getting something on the ballot?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gorley, number one, I don't think the charge of the commission per se is to come up with revenue options. It's to
I understand
do the model.
The charge of the commission, and I'm really speaking to you in your role as a citizen of Oregon who carries a civic role in the community, as well as, yes, you are in a leadership role with the Quality Education Commission. But I'm speaking to you in your role as an Oregon citizen, recognizing that we are in dire straits, and we're stuck, and we need to move ourselves forward.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, speaking as a citizen, I believe our tax structure is broken. It's a problem. It's not a balanced stool, and we need to look at how we can reform it to make it more balanced, because I think the cause and effect we already have is a number of people have left our state that have high income and have moved across the river and directly in the Portland area, which has caused some drain on the tax system. And I think it causes the business attractiveness problem for creating new jobs and growth. And so I think we do need to look at a four-way system that includes some form of sales-type tax, income tax, property tax, and fees. It has to be balanced. And I think in that, there can be a structure that works that will create a fair sharing with the education system, as long as that system, again, is built around an integrated approach that deals with some of the other issues we're dealing with. Because the problem is, even for areas like high school reform, it's great to say we're going to go work on all these reinventions. But the problem is, it doesn't happen in high school. If our grades and our performance is dropping in middle school, and we have 20% of the kids aren't making it past third grade standard, it doesn't matter, in many respects, what we do at high school, because we're going to be just doing work to try to get these kids back to standard. And we're spending a lot of, way too much time in that kind of activity. So it's both a practice process to make it more efficient, and it's a revenue process that funds it adequately.
Thank you.
I'll take the chair's prerogative to have a final comment. I very much appreciated your testimony. I think one of the things about centralizing some functions in terms of accounting and actually some of the information on students and maybe some other things in terms of payroll issues and human services are probably very beneficial in a different sense. Also, they probably relieve schools of some of those responsibilities and enable them to devote more to the responsibilities that they're for, just like your managers. Your managers are there to sell product. Superintendents and teachers are there to teach kids. That's some benefit. I think there's some benefits in centralization, but to use a military analogy on it, my military experience is quite a bit different from Representative Wisnant's, and I very rarely ever worked in my occupational specialty. But when I did, due to sort of administrative policies of the then incumbent president, who will remain nameless, and restrictions on the Department of Defense.
Is that Calvin Coolidge?
No, it's not Calvin Coolidge.
Abe Lincoln?
Yes, we could not retain enough supplies in my unit, which my particular subunit was an electronics maintenance unit. So we could not retain enough capacitors, resistors, and that's really dating myself to say that there were capacitors, resistors, and diodes that you could actually handle. And so we would basically, because it would take 2 months to get the resistor to bring the equipment back up or to get a capacitor, we would go out to Radio Shack and buy it out of our own pocket. Probably cost 1/100th of what the Department of Defense paid for it, but that's a different issue. But sometimes things can be so centralized that it straps you, you know, at the basic performance level. And I might give you a chance to comment, too. I didn't want to...
Chair Devlin, I agree. There are some things that don't make sense. And I think, again, it has to be a rational process you have to go through to look at what things make sense and don't. Let me give you a couple of examples that came out of the National Governors Conference that I thought were really kind of enlightening. If you look at what's happening in Rhode Island, they are leveraging Internet, too, as their backbone for their systems for schools. Now, there's a wonderful thing that happens there. Number one, not only do you have a standard across the system, but you can deliver video and a lot of technology tools to the classroom for distance learning that also start to deal with issues of replacing textbooks, because you can standardize them online, and when you have a change, you make the change online, you don't reprint a textbook. Think about that implication. Secondarily, look at Maine. Maine is putting a computer in the hands of every student in the classroom. And it's an advanced PDA. What are they finding? The kids that are coming from poverty families, they take those home, and their parents start to use them, and their unemployed parents many times are using those to do job searches and are finding that they are getting some side benefits socially from what's happened with the use of technology. So everything we look at, we have to understand the implications, but we also have to understand if it's going to add value to both the classroom and to the human capital side of what we're doing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to let Mr. Thrasher know, I don't know if you're aware of it, but Springfield School District is doing that in at least one of their schools, and I'm real curious to see what the results will be from that. But initially, they're finding the same thing that you just told us about Rhode Island. And I want to thank you for your thoughtful answer as a citizen to Senator Gordley's question.
Chair Devlin, Senator Walker, thank you.
Thank you very much. We will close the hearing on 5509, and we will come back tomorrow morning and resume our discussions.
planning board session.